there was a lot of, you know, folks talking about KIXEYE back in the day, and it'd be great to get your perspective on the past as well as where the future of free-to-play is going. But definitely want to welcome you to the podcast.
Thanks for having me.
I thought we could start just by asking you about, you know, kind of like you, your reputation. Would it be fair to say that you're sort of a controversial figure in the free-to-play game development community? And maybe you could talk about how do you currently perceive yourself and kind of like the history of KIXEYE?
So it's going to be one of those interviews. What do I think of myself? I think I'm pretty great.
Yeah. By the way, I'm a fan, just so you know.
Nah, we're all fans, right? Yeah, look, it's fair to say that. I mean, I can't argue with someone's feelings about me. However, I think a lot of people who don't know me very well confuse some of our early marketing messaging with who I am as a person, or as an entrepreneur, or as a CEO. I certainly did some PR stunts to get the company attention that sometimes had negative consequences on my image, which I fully accept. Okay. I was pretty direct in interviews. And yeah, you know, sometimes I loved the attention. I mean, it was kind of my first real job as a CEO. Hadn't really been in the press before. And, you know, sometimes when you kind of get that first, you know, first, I guess, arena of reception, you know, you might, it gets a little bit to one's head a little bit. But yeah, I liked the attention for a while, but then I didn't. I haven't done a lot of press over the last few years for a number of reasons. One, I brought too much negative attention to myself. We had some, I'd say, security issues with users coming to the office with pretty bad intentions. I mean, we actually had to have armed guards at the office after a few times. Two, it really didn't serve a great business purpose. You know, it's not like I was trying to gain investors or more large enterprise clients. I mean, I don't think PR is really the best use of one's time when you're in a straight B2C environment where you can do direct user acquisition. So it really just didn't serve a business process. So we sort of just shut off PR outside of marketing efforts outside of kind of direct consumer communication. So, you know, mostly just focused on making great products, working with great people. But yeah, I get it on the controversy side, but I think a lot of it was being a little misunderstood and confusing. And this is my fault too. I mean, we had a pretty aggressive marketing message, and yeah, it's kind of part of image and brand building, maybe a little bit misguided at the time.
Right. And I think that maybe a lot of the industry, their perception of KIXEYE and of you in particular may have been colored by that really famous KIXEYE recruitment video that was posted in 2012, which I personally thought was, you know, quite entertaining and different. But do you think that, you know, some of the jabs from that video that, you know, I mean, you know, you kind of like called out to some degree, like Zynga, EA, Kabam. Do you think that maybe people have taken that a little bit too far or personally, whereas you were just, you know, it seemed like the intent from my perspective as a, you know, outsider, and this is the first time we're meeting live and in person, but like, I felt that was, you guys were just trying to be kind of lighthearted and fun, although I can see how some people took it very personally.
Yeah. I think only one person really took it the wrong way initially, but I'd like to think he and I buried the hatchet. I have a lot of respect for everyone parried in that video, all, you know, very successful leaders. You know, at least one I'm very good friends with. But, you know, I think everyone could use a roast every once in a while, including me. Not that we directly parodied anyone specific. I mean, it's not like the old guy was supposed to be John Riccitiello. I am good friends with John and I explained that, even though he thought it was funny when he first saw it. But, you know, outside of the video, I called some of our competitors out for making blatant shitty ripoffs of our products. Unfortunately for us, Supercell made a really good ripoff and put it on a platform which we weren't competing in yet. But, you know, I was very direct in the press and in interviews, and sometimes my humor is a little dry. I mean, look, there's two kinds of people. There's people, people think I'm funny, and then people with no sense of humor. So, yeah, look, again, I admit that maybe I like to press some buttons sometimes, and maybe my humor is a little too dry, and I do offend people, and that's something that's happened. I mean, I can be polarizing, including my personal life, maybe not as much as how I was maybe in some of the press and with some marketing and with the recruiting video, but I don't think really the recruiting video was really a source of much controversy. I think overall it's pretty well received. I mean, for God's sakes, our recruiting numbers, if I recall correctly, I mean, probably went up like thousands of percent in terms of, of resumes. I mean, it was crazy. But yeah, I think, you know, I don't think anybody was really, really hurt or offended other than maybe one person, but, okay. It's in the past.
Well, maybe let's talk about that issue that you're raising about that, the company that became very successful. And I assume you're talking about Backyard Monsters and how Supercell kind of took Backyard Monsters, brought it to mobile, and essentially Clash of Clans today.
Yes.
But during those early days, you know, Kixeye, you guys were just really whooping some ass, right? Backyard Monsters, War Commander, Battle Pirates, Desktop, Tower Defense on the social side. But can you talk about maybe a couple of questions here? First, in terms of like, in terms of innovation, it felt like Kixeye was really doing a great job in terms of innovation, but then you guys didn't quite make the transition to mobile. Or maybe you could talk about how sure. you interpreted that time and kind of what happened.
Yeah. So, I mean, I guess kind of going back to the company's inception or how I came to work with Dave and Paul. So, you know, to be clear, Dave and Paul had founded a company called Casual Collective before I came on board. Mm-hmm. And Desktop Tower Defense was their biggest game. That was kind of Paul's invention. You know, meanwhile, I had exited another non-gaming company, and I wanted to work in gaming. Gaming has kind of been a long time passion of mine. And I had a very specific idea which I wanted to execute. And it was making a game like Command & Conquer, but making a true MMO out of it. And this is something I'd wanted to do since I initially played, you know, Dune 2 and Command & Conquer, which are kind of the first real RTSs. I hated how, you know, you play a session of Command & Conquer and then your base goes away. You had to like start all over again. I wanted like a 24/7 theater of battle. So that was like, I think the real, you know, idea that, that created the full kind of MMORTS innovation. And it just so happened when I was meeting with Dave and Paul about talking about restarting the company and making Kixeye is that Dave had had a game called Desktop Creatures, which I saw could be made into the vision of what I had. And we all, and the three of us kind of brought a lot of things to the table to make what eventually became Backyard Monsters. But the real thing that made us successful is that the three of us bring different things to the table, but kind of create kind of a perfect fit in terms of team, in terms of execution and creativity. That eventually got diluted. So initially we made Backyard Monsters. It's a good game, but you know, the market was pretty raw then. I mean, we launched Backyard Monsters without even sound. And I think, I mean, there was no chat in the game. I remember that the defensive towers hadn't even had a pass from art. We were using like cubes and cylinders, I think. I mean, we launched it pretty prematurely because we didn't have a lot of choice. We didn't have a lot of funding. We needed to see if this thing was viable or not. And sure enough, yeah, it was really viable. So it was pretty fresh. And yeah, we had a big advantage of that because, and thank God, because we're doing a lot of things wrong. It didn't monetize all that well. It still monetized a bit like a casual game. So we had to learn a whole lot. I mean, probably monetize maybe 2x better than like something like Farmville on a you know ARPU KPI basis, but you know nowhere close to kind of what we're doing now or what other Kixeye games did. So the real innovation is putting the three of us together and putting a team around us to execute the things and have us kind of carefully curate and be stewards of that experience and process. And then we followed on quickly with Battle Pirates, which was a much bigger hit financially, and then War Commander as well, which did about as well as Battle Pirates. And the things got kind of a little fucked up after that, and really around the pressure to scale. And at the time I was thinking, wow, we just made three great hits that are making us millions and millions of dollars a month. This video game thing is pretty easy. Let's just hire a whole bunch of people and just like give them funding and like just start making a whole bunch of games. Well, that plan turned out to be garbage. It turned out to be a lot harder. I mean, at the time I didn't really think that Dave, Paul and I had anything that special. We were just doing what we were doing. And I thought, well, you know, we just need to give people the opportunity and make some games and we'll just create this $50 billion juggernaut and just keep making games. It's so easy. So we scaled and hired a whole bunch of people and sort of just spread the brain trust around, and things just kind of didn't go as well at all.
And just for the audience, like the initial launches and success of these games were on social, right? So Facebook, MySpace.
Yeah, they were all on Facebook.
And it's interesting that you're saying that maybe part of the issue was just the amount of initial success where then it caused you to think it was so easy. But I also noticed that some of the biggest winners on the mobile side were the biggest losers on the social side and went to mobile because
they had to.
They had nowhere else to go.
Like Supercell was a tremendous loser on Facebook.
Oh yeah.
Their first Gunshine game I think was Gunshine, which is god awful. Yeah. I mean when we were playing that game, I'm like, okay, well these guys aren't a threat. I mean it's a beautiful looking game. It was a fun little experience, but it's like, wow, these guys don't know shit about monetization or retention or anything. And and if I'm not mistaken, I think Ilka then joined them after that was released because he was still, I think, GM over at Digital Chocolate working for my friend and board member, Trip Hawkins. Right. And they'd been studying Backyard Monsters and they'd already tried.
Yeah, they created that Alien game too,
yeah,
right?
Which was a much better. Something. Yeah, Galaxy Conquest or something or whatever something like it was. That, yeah. And so he kind of already had a roadmap of how to copy it, and then just so he already had a head start. And then remember Supercell, okay guys, here's what we're doing. We're gonna make a better version of Farmville and a better version of Backyard Monsters because these clowns aren't on mobile yet. Ha ha, stupid them, let's do it. And yeah, that pretty much worked for them. So yeah, and versus we had some incumbency syndrome. We thought, hey, what are you guys, where's everyone going? The water's fine. Like this is easy. We're making so much money. This is, you know, we don't need to do mobile. I mean, a lot of my resistance to mobile initially is because I personally didn't want to play games on a small form factor. And there were two things that mobile didn't satisfy for me. One is the form factor in this small screen. I wanted to basically make PC-style games, but really accessible and not having to use a download. Like you're at your desk at your office, you can quickly go to another tab and play the game and then get out of it, not have to have like a gaming PC or something. And the other is that we were really on the client side, we were really more web developers. We didn't have to be, you know, full game engineers. We were using Flash and creating basically an executable on a device was totally contrary to how I saw the company as an engineer. And I have a background as a software engineer, and I wanted to do straight up game as a service, kind of web service, and just make it hyper accessible from a technology perspective. So those two things were kind of big hurdles for me to climb over. I predicted that the market would go the other way. I didn't think the App Store would have the stranglehold, because typically you see things shift away from walled gardens and things became more open and accessible. At the time I predicted that mobile would come to us and that we would be delivering things within a mobile browser. So I didn't need to invest in it. I think eventually I'll be proven right.
That's the Trip Hawkins story, right? Like,
well, he and I, and he and I connected on that shared vision.
Okay,
he
actually,
when he was running Digital Chocolate, he saw us and came to me and tried to buy the company in the very early days. And we definitely connected over kind of a shared view and vision. He was earlier to it than I was. I mean, he was so early that, you know, it kind of killed the company, but, you know, they shifted and it's like they went from mobile back into browser and, you know, he was just way too ahead of his time. Right. Where was I? So anyway, you know, part of it was my personal aversion for doing kind of small form factor devices too. I just built a company that scaled on completely different technology. So I could not turn the ship that fast. And by the time that I realized, oh shit, I need to make this happen, it's a little too late. Versus like a small, nimble company like Supercell, like they were desperate. Like they'd raised some money. Their first game was a total failure. And it's like, okay, let's do something more predictable. Boom, here's this new greenfield market. Let's go jump in the App Store and put some games out there. So yeah, they crushed it because they made a very critically good strategic decision.
So if you were to think back in terms of that time, let's call it 2010, 2015, and it sounded like because of the early success and traction on social, you guys were a little bit late coming into mobile. But if you were to just characterize like the mobile free-to-play market at that time and why, like maybe you could, it'd be great to hear from you about specifically how then did you try to get into mobile and what happened? And then during that time, why did some companies like Supercell succeed? Maybe just because, you know, that's all they had and they had the playbook and things like that. And then Zynga was able to, being late to mobile as well, but they were somehow able to succeed. Do you have any thoughts on that?
Well, so with Supercell, I mean, again, they were kind of first to market with a quality product. Right. And they've been able to leverage their brand and distribution and, you know, economies of scale and figure it out. I mean, they would, if they were coming in right now, they would not succeed with their current products. No way. They don't monetize well enough to afford advertising. I don't even know why they're paying for user acquisition because it's totally negative ROI. So, you know, they've built a brand and hats off to them. They were first to the punch and they've built a multi-billion dollar business. It's great to see that my concept is so successful. But in terms of Zynga, you know, they fortunately had a lot more runway than we did to figure it out. I mean, they had about $1 billion of cash or so, and they could afford other acquisitions. They could afford a lot more shots on goal to eventually figure it out. And they figured it out with a new management team. Frank and Bernard are super talented managers. And I'm a little surprised that they did as well as they did. I didn't think anyone would be able to turn that ship around. I mean, that's quite the turnaround. So they had a lot more cash, a lot more shots on goal. And Kingdom Maker is proof that we would have able, I know that, you know, it's not proof to everybody out there because the story is not written, but I mean, I see the KPIs, I see the trajectory. I know that this is successful, but I think Kingdom Maker proves me right that we had the right game plan. We just didn't have enough cash to do it within the old company. So, you know, there's a lot of ways to skin the cat. There's a lot of ways to figure it out. Some people are successful. Some people aren't. A lot of it's due to timing, a lot of it due to funding. I mean, there's things outside one's control. There are things that people can fully control. I mean, it totally depends. Each thing has its own different story.
I also thought what was kind of interesting about that time was just how much or how important distribution was at that time in the sense that when we look at a lot of the other companies that were successful from that era, like Storm8, Pocket Gems, there were like a bunch of companies that came from like Tapjoy, you know, ex-Tapjoy people, ex-Tapjoy intern, these guys that learned about, you know, the incentivized app install model. And then even I heard that Supercell leveraged, I forgot the name of the company. You know, those guys that wore those orange jumpsuits at the conferences, but they built this huge business off of like affiliate marketing or something like that. And, but what I heard is that Supercell was able to grow off of striking partnerships with some of those like distribution partners and ad networks during that time.
Yeah, I don't think that's entirely true. I mean, that certainly is a piece of it, but
right. Yeah, I don't think it's
the answer. They got so much support from the platforms after early success. I mean, they would just get massive amounts of featuring no matter what. Now they have a big DAU network that can cross promote. They have a lot of leverage and power now, but no, I don't think there was anything. Any kind of creative deal smithing that was really significantly involved in their success.
And if you were to look
some of the other companies that you mentioned, yes. Yeah. I mean, they were, on a smaller scale, yeah, you could make it happen back in the day, and now you can't really. And a lot of people just took advantage of really cheap user acquisition. I mean, it was really cheap to buy users in some cases. So things change, tides change, costs change, channels change, and there's always a way to figure it out. I mean, gaming isn't going away. People like to play games. There's places for advertising and promotion. There's a way to figure it out.
If you were to think back on KickSci and maybe the biggest lesson that you've learned or that you feel that you would have done differently, what would you say that would have been?
I think the biggest thing is to scale more thoughtfully, but I mean, you don't often get the opportunity to redo things. And I'm kind of doing that now with Global Worldwide. But the two biggest lessons, it's really scale more thoughtfully and react faster to market shifts. And now I know what to really look for when that happens again. And I was really keen to initially jump on the VR bandwagon and then jump off it quicker than most when I realized that it just wasn't going to work. I've been very keen looking at blockchain and NFTs and things like that. It's not quite the same thing. We can talk more about that later, but, it's really about scaling very thoughtfully. Hiring is so important, and it's a lot easier to hire the wrong person than the right person, and simply recognizing market shifts and when to take advantage of that.
And maybe I could ask you about today. So right now we're all operating in a different environment from those old days, but as you know, someone part of the old guard, seeing that old environment and the lessons that you've learned, and when you look at the current market, how would you characterize like some of the biggest changes or even the current challenges for a game studio to become successful in the current market today?
Well, operating in free to play, I mean, if you want to do what we're doing, which is we're still, you know, chasing yield with user acquisition and trying to, you know, monetize players more than what we acquire them for. I mean, you got to bring your A game, and you really have to have full economic mastery of this kind of system and game design. And that's a really tall order. I think there's really just a handful of teams out there that can do it in today's market. If you're coming to this fresh, you can maybe create something truly innovative that gets the attention that goes viral. I try to avoid that because that's where it just hits driven. It's not very predictable. I feel that there are a certain number of parameters that if one stays within and iterates on, you can make a successfully, I mean, then you sprinkle on, you know, you innovate here and there. I mean, look at a kind of a risk portfolio where it's like you do some things you know are going to work. You do some things that maybe others have proven to work. Then you do some things just throw it up against the wall. If you have a good creative mind and are innovative, like you can think, you can perhaps, if you're lucky enough to think about what other people want before they know that they want it, sprinkle that in, which I think we have a better chance than many of doing. And look, it's hard. I mean, there are easier markets to make money in. There are easier ways to make money. I really try to dissuade people who don't have much of an affinity for gaming that go into this market just to make money. I think that's just a terrible idea. And people have done it. And have done well with it, but it kind of saddens me. I mean, at the end of the day, I think people have to be thoughtfully aligned on two vectors simultaneously, which is making an authentic, great game that you would play yourself and have a plan for how it actually really makes money and keeps the lights on and returns money to you and your employees or shareholders or investors or whatever. Like, you have to treat those things with equal weight, basically. And I think most people fail because they're overly weighting one or the other.
Got it. And well, when you talk about economic mastery and that second thing that you're talking about, do you mean more around the understanding of different forms of monetization, understanding like ARPU curves, ROAS, just like the way that you make money on your players. Is that what you mean? Or is there something else as part of that?
It's part that. It's part how the economy within the game is modeled, which is far more complicated, that eventually yields those ARPU curves. I mean, we have something like 7 million rows of data in Kingdomaker. I mean, that's just the game variables, like the values, not like user data or something like that. It's the stuff that makes the game tick. It took years to figure out.
Okay. So 2019, Stillfront acquired KIXEYE for, I think it was reported, $120 million cash and potential earnout. And then you kind of went on to found your current company, Global Worldwide. Could you talk about that transition from KIXEYE to Global Worldwide? And then in a LinkedIn post, you had mentioned that Kingdomaker has actually been in development for 6 years. And so was that part of KIXEYE? Was that spun out? Or maybe you could also speak to that.
Yeah, so Kingdomaker started, let me start with that. So Kingdomaker started development in early 2015. So it's been 7.5 fun-filled years. And Kingdomaker was started to kind of serve two purposes. One, we had several different code bases floating around the company. They were all doing practically the same thing, but not very well. I mean, our engineering that was kind of started in the early days, which is not great. I mean, Dave and Paul were both active engineers. In addition to being game designers, I was not personally contributing to the code, but we started with things that just didn't scale well in the first place. And we just kept maintaining them and kept adding to them. And I wanted like a fresh technical start, build some architecture that could serve future MMORTS games at KIXEYE more efficiently and reliably. We had a lot of downtime. I think there's one time where we had 2 days of consecutive downtime with Battle Pirates, and we had to turn off events for non-playing customers. Like if you hadn't spent more than like $50 in the game, then we wouldn't let you access the game for 2 days until the active users had died down and our servers could actually support it. It was bad. Like we cost ourselves a lot of upside because our engineering wasn't good from the early days. So I wanted to have some sound functional engineering and architecture from the get-go and create a code base that we could actually use, leverage, and scale. So I took the best engineers around the company. A lot of them were working on a PC game that I decided to cancel in favor of just going all in on mobile and making something awesome. And then two, had an idea for kind of the ultimate RTS, the combined elements of role-playing and sim, all in one. And it was a very big, grand vision that I knew would take a long time to execute. So I didn't want any risk, but in terms of if it would work or not, I was going to put everything in there that I knew how to do and just make an awesome game that I wanted people to play for decades and make sure that it really lent itself well to managing and scaling live operations. Because it's all about that at the end of the day. It's a game as a service. So yeah, so Kingdomaker started at the beginning of 2015. We got to the point around 2018, late 2018, where we're getting to where I needed to provide some liquidity to my venture investors. And unfortunately, the market was kind of seeing us as two different companies. Like we had kind of the legacy products still on Facebook and our own website. We had some mobile properties like War Commander, Rogue Assault, and Vega Conflict that were doing pretty well. But then Kingdomaker was like this, almost seemed like a new venture. And, I got some investment opportunities, some offers, some whole acquisition offers that I just didn't think fairly valued Kingdomaker. So we took an offer that allowed us to sell, the legacy stuff and allow me to kind of divest Kingdomaker into a different organization and continue on with that. I mean, so Global Worldwide is really KIXEYE. It's the founding team. It's the core engineers and designers and marketers that were close to me and working since the very early days. It's just that Stillfront wanted the brand with it. So like, okay, fine, take it. I can make up another brand name. And yeah, so Stillfront bought the legacy KIXEYE portfolio along with a lot of the team. I divested the Kingdomaker IP and technology and the people that were working on that into a new company. So it's fully 100% independent, not at all owned by Stillfront, not associated. I don't keep in touch with them. I don't keep in touch with KIXEYE. You know, we're fully much on our own path right now.
Okay. And if I'm correct, you guys are located in Atlanta. Could you speak to that? Why Atlanta? And is everybody there? Or are you kind of doing like the remote thing, or how's that working?
Yeah, about half of us are here. The rest are kind of distributed all over. We have a lot of people in California. We have some in Australia, some in Canada. I think a couple in Texas and Michigan. I don't know. Depends on what the role is. But yeah, about half are in Atlanta. So I grew up in a small town named Rome, Georgia, which is in the northwest center of the state. I lived in Atlanta for a few years after college before eventually moving out west. Have a lot of family and friends here, and a lot of us are really just sick of the Bay Area. Like I'd wanted to leave San Francisco starting around 2015, but couldn't since I had KIXEYE. I had my first kid in 2016, and that's when I really started to see how terrible San Francisco was to raise a family. Just bums everywhere, dirty. I mean, it's just disgusting. You look at things through a very different lens. And so we were kind of hating on San Francisco before it was cool. You know, we left right before COVID, and then all of a sudden the exodus started after that. So talked to some of the members of the team and wanted to see, hey, what do you guys think about Atlanta? Others were feeling the same way. So moved, I think, around 20 people or so and hired some more. The company's around 60 people or so, which is a lot smaller than KIXEYE was. Most of the core team moved here to Atlanta. We still have a few holdouts from the original team out in California. Paul actually moved to Colorado because he just wants to be near the mountains. I don't know. But Dave's here with me as well. And both those guys were originally from London. Atlanta kind of ticked off a lot of the boxes. I mean, it was over the edge for me personally, since I have a lot of family and friends here, knew the area, could plug in quickly. But just where we are, most of us here have families, different life stage, and we're just kind of sick of the Bay and just the disgustingly poorly run city of San Francisco. It's kind of heartbreaking. I don't think Silicon Valley is going to be really recreated in our lifetime anywhere. Certainly not there, but it's all kind of spread out now.
Yeah, I'm hoping things turn around in San Francisco, but I do have to agree things are kind of depressing the way.
Well, people just aren't going to be coming back. I mean, one of the things that made San Francisco so great is this tremendous collection of incredibly smart, talented people. And now they've dispersed. I think some will come back, but you know, a lot of them you get over somewhere else and it's like, hey, this place is pretty great. I mean, I think you get a little brainwashed being out there and thinking everything is so awesome. And there's a lot of really great areas of the world. But it depends on your life stage, it depends on your priorities and things like that.
Yeah.
But it's a shame.
You know, one of the really interesting aspects of KIXEYE when you guys were here in San Francisco, I got to visit the office and, you know, you come out of the elevator and then, you know, just that experience going into the KIXEYE office from a cultural perspective. And was wondering if you could comment on the culture that you kind of instilled in the early KIXEYE and, you know, some criticism around that too. Like some people would just, you know, call it, for lack of a better word, maybe a bro culture at that time. But could you comment on how you are viewing company culture then and what is the culture at Global Worldwide today?
Yeah, so a few things to address there. I think there are kind of a few points and questions. Number one, I mean, look, I fully reject the whole bro culture label that anyone tried to label us. I mean, I think it really, again, was influenced by some of our marketing and content of our games, which were certainly a little more male-focused and skewed. But we had a far more diverse employee base than any other game company at the time that I was aware of, and actually had like some diversity award, which kind of rejected because I thought it was kind of silly. I mean, we hire based on merit. That's just how the chips fell. But Yeah, I mean, I don't think like our office decoration had anything to do with that. I mean, we're just trying to do something cool.
I just thought that was cool. You know, because yeah, you could tell it's a different vibe. It's like,
I thought it was cool too. I mean, like, I'm into theatrics and doing neat stuff. I mean, at the end of the day, we're making video games. So let's like make the office kind of like a video game. And yeah, again, I think, you know, some of the press and marketing and some of my comments were perceived differently than I had intended. But bro culture, I mean, at the end of the day, we're just a bunch of nerds making video games. So I think all of us were beaten up by bros and at one point in high school or whatever. So, we're just a bunch of nerds making video games, and that's still the case. In terms of the culture now versus then, I'd say the culture of Global Worldwide is what I wished KIXEYE was back in the day. It's just I didn't have the opportunity to attract and hire the kind of talent that I have now. I mean, again, at the beginning, like, we were just scraping by with – well, we just didn't know what we were doing, and we weren't able to attract the quality of engineers and designers that we have now. And I think, you know, looking around the office at Global Worldwide and the people I see on Zoom calls, I mean, this is the most exceptional team I've ever worked with. At the end of the day, I mean, I think culture is kind of a misused or overused word in the corporate landscape. I mean, what does that even mean? It's just, it's a product of the people that you hire. And I think some people put too much artificial influence over culture because their product and the company, that the thing that they're doing is just not that exciting. So they have to talk about culture. Like, we're making something really exciting and really fun. And there's a reason to kind of jump out of bed and get to work every day. And so we don't have to really talk about all these ancillary, superficial things that make this company great. What makes this company great is we have a lot of really amazing people that we work with and get to work with every day. And we're working on a fucking incredible product. That's the culture. And it's about hiring just really passionate, dedicated, hardworking masters of their craft. And, you know, that's the culture. And I wanted just to be surrounded by really smart people. And I mean, I think that, you know, pretty soon I could probably get hit by a bus and Kingdom Maker will do really well. That was not the case in the early days of KIXEYE. So I think I'm finally doing my job. So,
right. So it sounds like if I were to characterize working at Global Worldwide, the perspective on culture is really not about like a set of values or rules or principles. It's just about good people, focus on the product, and if you hire good people and have an exciting product, good things will happen. Is that a good characterization of how you think about it?
Yeah. I mean, we certainly have values. I mean, it's really respect employment law, respect people, focus on the product, you know, hire great people, have fun. I mean, it's not complicated.
Okay. And maybe kind of going back to Kingdom Maker, I do think that, and by the way, you know, I just hear a lot of things, but the word on the street is that the KPIs are pretty good. You don't have to confirm or deny that, but could you speak about more specifically what the game is, and maybe even going back to like how you thought about starting the game, and then having worked on it for 6 years, it seems like you believed in this for quite a long time. What made you believe in it? You know, ahead of data, ahead of, you know, kind of launch and things like that.
Yeah. Well, you know, backing up, when we first made Backyard Monsters, Battle Pirates, War Commander, I thought the shelf life on that stuff was about a year and a half. And so that was one of the reasons why I scrambled to scale the company and try to create all these studios. I'm like, oh my God, I just need to fill the pipeline. Knowing what I know now, I would have not worked on anything other than mobile versions of those games, just extending the game. Because I mean, at the end of the day, how many games does it take to make a multi-billion-dollar gaming company?
One.
And we know what works. We know what's missing. I think people spend too little time on the V1 of the game. And if you're thinking about this in terms of the way I think about Kingdom Maker is it's a multi-decade experience. There's already games out there that have been around for multi-decades. How long has Counter-Strike now been out for? How many years has World of Warcraft been out for? But knowing that, and then that kind of changes one's perspective on payback for marketing and how big and how broad you want the game. I just thought that the games that we've made and the games out in the market were just too limiting from a user perspective. Like, I just kind of got bored with stuff. Like, I wanted more things to do and I wanted more reasons to keep people around. And that's why we made Kingdom Maker both deeper and broader, which most people, it's counterintuitive to most people. Most people think you really got to focus on one pillar and don't try to be all things to all people. No, I'm like, fuck that. Like, it needs to be a lot of things to more people if you want to create a big ecosystem. I mean, look at the world. The world works. You can go out there and choose to do anything that you want to do. I can go be a fireman. I can go be a doctor. I'm going to go choose to go to a rave now. I'm going to go do this. Like, you know, we're talking about kind of the metaverse. You know, there is some metaversey kind of stuff going on in Kingdom Maker. We want to nail social, and it's about kind of social expression, not necessarily being on like a social platform or something, but allowing people to play the game in maybe different ways. So at the end of the day, Kingdom Maker is about power. It's a game of power and it's a war game. But, you know, war is not necessarily, I mean, look at modern day, you know, geopolitical warfare. It's not just with direct combat. It's with influence, espionage, intrigue, economic. You know, I wanted there to be a way for players to play a little bit differently, especially in the PvP loop. Like, if someone who doesn't want to actually engage in active combat with somebody, is there somehow that they can maybe topple their enemy or do something different other than just sending a bunch of troops in? So needed to put a human face. That's where the nobles came from, and kind of the keep cutaway, and allowing people to do different things to other people. Like, there should be 1,000 different ways to collaborate with somebody and 1,000 different ways to stab somebody in the back. Like, that's the real innovation in this game. Yeah, I mean, there's a bunch of different innovations, I think. But so I thought, wow, this is a pretty grand vision. It's going to take us some time. I know this will work. And I mean, that's what's going to set us apart. We dream big and we can put our money where our mouth is. So, the KPIs, obviously, we wouldn't be spending a ton on marketing and launching it globally if the KPIs weren't already great. So I think I don't know anyone who's launching a game like this without good KPIs. That'd be pretty terrible.
Sure. Yeah. And in terms of, like, you know, ahead of data, when you were working on the game, did you take more of the approach of more the, like, the Steve Jobs or Blizzard approach of, like, you felt like you understood what a good game or a good product would be for an audience and just kind of, you know, made a number of decisions in terms of the game design, kind of like opinion-based decisions? Or did you try to validate through testing or other types of things ahead of launch?
50-50. So 100% in the beginning, I was pretty direct about, like, I mean, I wrote a product brief. I'm like, hey, I'm recruiting internally for people to make this game, and here's what it is, here's what it isn't. And do you want to work on this? And people would kind of buy into the vision. So I made sure that people really bought into the vision. But the way that I work, it's like, look, I put assumptions out there. But then when we had the presence of data, we let data drive a lot of the decisions. So we definitely iterated on different systems and things like that. But yes, I mean, I solely came up with the initial kind of feature set and parameter set to kind of keep people within kind of a canvas, and then of course delegated and hired designers to flesh out systems and things like that. I get into the weeds in some areas, but for the most part, you know, want to empower and delegate people and make sure that they have a sense of ownership and they're making great stuff, and there's stuff that they're doing that I can't do. So I'd say short answer is it's mixed. I mean, I don't want to compare myself to Steve Jobs or others, but yeah, I mean, I had a pretty specific vision initially, but we're fortunate to be in a world where data, there's a fire hose of data that you can read and help make your product better. And you really have to kind of ignore, once that's out there, you have to ignore the qualitative feedback and really, really listen to the quantitative feedback. So,
right.
Yeah, so it's really both. It's both intuition and data. But obviously, as you get more more scale in the market, data is going to be driving a lot of the tuning in either confirming or rejecting a lot of your assumptions. But data can't take the place for innovation and invention. You still have to think, okay, well, what should I do in the roadmap next? And take a bit of a risk management view of kind of the portfolio of features where we have, okay, here are the obvious stuff that's missing that we've done in other games, or it's well established that other competitors in the genre are doing this well. The other is, we see maybe someone else doing it and I think it might work. And we should do that, or maybe the users are asking us for it. And then, the last bit is like, let's just put our thinking caps on and throw some stuff up against the wall that we think would be really cool to put in there that would entertain us. And, that's the riskier bets. But you got to kind of have the standbys and the things you know are going to work. And then, you definitely need to have a creative imagination to think about what people might want, but just don't know that they want it yet.
Right. And maybe now, just if I could ask you about the distribution side. And so the game is being published by Scopely, and if to the degree that you can talk about that specific relationship, great. But otherwise, I just wanted to get your thoughts in terms of the current market environment and like the generic decision of going with a publisher or not. What would you generally be looking for from a publisher? And and to the extent that you can, as much detail about the specific decision with Scopely, if you can talk about it.
Yeah. So we were already in test market. Kingdomaker was already live a couple of years ago when we signed a deal with Scopely. But we had a lot of different options, some straight VC options for funding, a couple other strategic options like Scopely, and also some outright acquisition options as well. I chose the Scopely deal because I thought it was the best mix, and they have had some tremendous success in some other areas. They had the money to market this thing, and we had a lot of just good vision alignment. They'd hired a lot of my Kixeye product managers, some of the better ones, and actually someone who used to work at Kixeye is now kind of the lead on the Scopely side for this game that we have a really tight relationship with. I mean, everybody we work with there and everybody we interact with is just aces. A lot of synergy between the companies and the teams. And so it's gone really, really well. And so we definitely bet right on that. I had the opportunity to just go in kind of the fully independent Kixeye route and raise more rounds of venture funding. But I knew that we had something hot and we needed to have a partner that was going to spend massive amounts of money on marketing. And in order to do that, the VC route, I'd have to just keep raising money and just doing more, more dilutive rounds of funding. So can't say much more, but, chose the strategic route with Scopely. Super thrilled with the partnership. Like I said, we didn't execute the deal until after we were in test market. We've done some co-development with them, and now we're kind of in the marketing phase and pretty stoked about the relationship. And, it's a great company to be partnered with for sure.
Awesome.
Was there another part to the question?
Maybe you could also just speak on, you mentioned marketing dollars from Scopely or a publisher, but just more generically, what should a game studio think about getting from a publisher in terms of value or benefits and things like that?
I mean, it depends on the genre and what you're competing. Marketing is really expensive now. And I think if you are really aiming to have like a top 10 grossing hit, like you need to spend hundreds of millions of dollars on marketing. A lot. So, and you can't really just go raise a Series A for $100 million out there. It's like, I would say, and I'm really enthused to see that some, pure gaming VC funds out there have raised some really big funds. I mean, I think there's, at least $3 billion, $4 billion worth of gaming funds out there right now.
Yeah.
Maybe a little more. A couple of them have like $750 million per fund.
Right.
So, you know, maybe a Series B. I mean, I think it's possible now that, you know, you get off the ground, you have something, you're in test market, KPIs look good. I mean, if I was a VC partner looking at games and I see the KPIs, I would immediately try to swoop in and try to take a big equity ownership and give them a huge check because I knew that it would be pretty predictable. I think once you get to a certain point of scale and you're operating within certain parameters, KPIs can be trusted to scale. You just don't know how big it's going to get. I know Kingdom Maker is going to be very successful. I just don't quite know where does the scale end. But it's going to be profitable exploring and finding that limit. But generally it's tough to get a brand new game company off the ground. If you haven't already done it before, you don't already have relationships. Cause again, marketing is expensive, development salaries are expensive, and it's not something that we just can kind of just slowly build up to. It's like, once you get to go live, you need to have the dollars to start pouring into this and you can't really stop. It's bad for the future upside.
Right. Okay. Well, I think I have one last question, which is really around, so you and I come from like the early mobile free-to-play environment. And now looking at the current landscape, there's a lot of stuff going on, right? There's Web3 ownership, blockchain, like really a fundamentally different UA landscape based upon IDFA deprecation. You've got now maybe a comeback of publishers. I mean, they've kind of disappeared for a while. You had a wave of M&A and consolidation, and now, you know, where is that? You know, although I think Embracer just raised $1 billion from the Saudis, but like a pretty kind of confusing landscape. And so if I were to ask you what you think about some of the biggest, whether it's opportunities or things that you're thinking about in terms of the current competitive landscape, what are those things?
Look, I think the opportunity is that there's always room for good, creative, innovative content. That's it. I think a lot of people get too spun up around like, you know, some very specific platforms or monetization techniques or whatever. But there's always room for great entertaining content to delight millions of people because there's so much garbage out there. I think if you have a creative mind, it's very easy to stand out. But again, like I said earlier, like you have to have equal focus to making a good creative fun experience. And how is this thing going to operate as a business? Now some of these new things, great to keep an eye on and master and figure out because it's going to make kind of the business part easier. NFTs. NFTs are so well suited for gaming. It's perfect. I think gaming might be one of the really only slam dunk opportunities for NFTs to really work. A lot of opportunities for blockchain. It's just kind of it's a methodology that can be applied to a lot of different stuff. Crypto is a whole other discussion. But, you know, it's important that everyone keep the pulse on the market and, you know what your competitors are up to. There's plenty of data out there that shows what's working, and you can dissect and just stay current with the market. But at the end of the day, like none of these things are substitutions for just creating a thoughtful, authentic, fun, innovative, creative experience for players. And again, I think people get too caught up in the other techniques and they get in the weeds on other things and they lose sight of like, is this going to be fucking fun? Is it fun? Is it interesting? Why is it worth my time? Like, you got to have that sort of product market fit first. Otherwise, the rest is just, you know, it's a waste of time.
Right. All right. Well, that was my last question. Maybe just to wrap this up, if I don't know if you have a final message for our audience or if someone wanted to get in touch with you, how would they do that?
Anyone can email me at will@globalworldwide.com. And final message is play Kingdom Maker. It's a lot of fun. Check it out.
Sounds good. All right. Thanks so much, Will.
Thank you.
Bye. All right.